The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, when you think of Ireland and sports, you don't generally think of Cool Runnings, the movie, of course, that John Candy starred in back in the, I'd say it was probably the early 90s maybe, with the Jamaican bobsleigh team. It was a true story, of course, and how they ended up going to the Olympics. But it was a great movie. But you don't necessarily think of that sport when it comes to Ireland. However, you will be very pleased to hear that we do indeed have a potential contender for the next Winter Olympics. That will be in Beijing in 2022. And his name is Brendan Doyle, and he's here in the studio with me. Brendan's got a fascinating story. You are currently, Brendan, Ireland's skeleton champion. Could I describe you as that?
You could indeed. I'm the only athlete at the moment, yeah.
You're the only athlete?
Yeah, just myself.
Well, we'll tell you you're the champion, so, Brendan.
I'll take it.
You've got an interesting story that involves you were a Garda at one point. But let me go back before you joined the Garda Síochána, mm-hmm. because you actually got into bobsleighing when you were a teenager.
Yeah, so
How was that? Because, I mean, I literally do think Ireland bobsleigh. Where's the connection there?
I actually thought the same. So I started off in track and field. I would train in Morton Stadium in Santry. So I actually got into track and field through my history teacher in St. David's in Artane. And I started then and, you know, I just kept training. And I was a sprinter. And that kind of work really crossed over well into skeleton. And the bobsled team at the time spotted me and they said, "Do you want to give this a go?" And I just jumped at the opportunity. And you know,
is that because you were a fast runner?
Yeah,
that's what they need.
Yeah, I'm a small dude, so it kind of works when I'm pushing the sled, because like when you're pushing a skeleton sled, you're kind of bent over, so it just worked for the body type that I have. So you know, I just used my skills from track and field and kind of put them into skeleton.
And so there was already a bobsleigh team that saw you and thought we'll have a bit of you. Were they up in Santry as well, or where were they training?
Yeah, they were training in Santry as well. So it was Siobhan and Eva Hoey. They were both training bobsled at that stage.
On what? What were they training at?
Pure Cool Runnings. It was a bobsled on wheels, and we were pushing it on the track.
Wow!
And that's how I train today. I have a skeleton sled out at the Sports Ireland Institute, and we just push it on the track. That's all I can do right now. So it's kind of how we train in the summer.
So there was no, when this was back when you were a teenager, mm-hmm. you started. So did you ever get the chance to go on ice with it?
Yeah, so a couple of weeks into just dry land training, they took me off to Innsbruck in Austria. And you kind of have to do a driving license. You kind of have to show that you're, because it's kind of a dangerous sport, right?
Yeah.
So you have to prove that you're able to do it. So I went off to Eagles, which is just outside Innsbruck, and I did my skeleton school week. And I remember the first time getting on the sled, they put you down and you're getting ready to go. And I just remember the guy behind me kicking me hard, and he was like, bye-bye, Ireland. And he just kicked me off, and that was my first taste of skeleton. So
scary?
Yeah, terrifying. Yeah.
Like being on a roller coaster, or were you screaming all the way down?
Yeah, being on a roller coaster that you can crash on and that you're in control of. Yeah, it's quite kind of intimidating.
How fast do you go? I mean, what's the average kind of speed that you're going when you're in one of those? And is this by yourself when you were doing this?
Yeah, training? This is by myself. You hit a top speed of 145 kilometres an hour.
Woo!
Yeah.
that's fast.
Yeah, you don't feel it at the time because you're so focused on what you're doing. But yeah, it can get pretty gnarly, all right.
And what was that for, like, if you go back to that very first time then in Austria, when mm-hmm. you got out and when you finished, like, when you said you don't feel it at the time, do you feel it afterwards?
Yeah, you're exhausted afterwards. You're shaking and you want to get back up and do it again. But by the time you get back up and do it again, the nerves have set in and you just don't want to do it again. So you just have to train that out of you, really.
So you got your license, as it were.
Your driving license.
Yep. And you come back. And so how old were you at this point?
I was like 17.
And,
yeah.
and so what was the, you know, was there a next step kind of in the bobsleigh area for you then? Were you going to compete?
Well, the idea was to get a team ready for Turin in 2006. But obviously there was limited funding and there was kind of other older athletes ahead of me. So they were taking the priority. So I was basically said that they said that, you know, you fund it yourself. Or you know, you can't do it. So I kind of had to kind of focus on my professional goals at that point.
And your professional goals, of course, brought you then to the Garda Síochána.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
So
yeah.
You became a guard.
Yeah, it was.
Why did you want to be a guard?
It was a dream job. It was so rewarding. You know, job satisfaction of being able to help and be in a community and be that person to help someone in need. It just draw me to the thing. And obviously, there's a bit of action too, but, you know, helping people means a lot to me.
And then you were a guard for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And something happened.
Yeah, so I was stationed in an inner city Dublin station, and I went into work one day, and there was a domestic assault call on hold. And these are normally very volatile by nature, and you know, we responded to the call, and when I got to the address, you know, I saw the suspect at the door. Now the suspect was armed with a wooden baton. And I tried to use my verbal reasoning skills to calm the suspect down and just to reason with them. But obviously that fell on deaf ears. And they actually armed themselves with a chef's knife. And it was during that kind of arrest where I received injuries.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many years had you been in the guards when this happened?
I would have been about a year, just over a year.
Okay. Yeah. So you sustained injuries?
Yeah.
Serious
injuries? I mean, there's obviously more serious injuries out there, but it was my hand was cut. So my right thumb, the nerves were severed, and one of my fingers is the ligament was sliced, and it's just constantly in a kind of a 90 degree angle.
I can see, yeah. And your little finger there.
Yeah,
on your right hand.
I'm going to need surgery for the rest of my life, because every time the surgery takes place, the ligament's actually going to shorten again. So I'm just going to keep needing surgery and skin grafts and so on. So it's something that I'm going to have forever, but I can't really do it now because the rehab time is too long. It'll cut into my training for the Olympics.
That's a very difficult thing to go through, even though I guess as a guard you're presumably prepared that anything could happen at any time.
Yeah.
How were you afterwards? What happened afterwards, despite the physical injuries?
So the physical, like, having my background in athletics and training, I was able to cope with the physical side of things. It was normal for me. And I remember getting home that night and, you know, I told my folks I was fine and whatever, and I went to sleep. And that was kind of my last night's sleep for a number of years. The following night, I was woken up to my first experience with a night terror, and it's such a kind of a visceral feeling. I had a dream that the suspect was there with the knife, and my hand was still bleeding, and my bed was covered in my blood, and I woke up having my hand grabbing my other hand, trying to stop the bleeding, and I would get this night in, night out, and I would be violently woken up. And, you know, once bitten, twice shy, that's very, very difficult to deal with, being kind of shaken awake. And I kind of started having problems with sleeping, and insomnia started crawling in. So that, for me, I feel the insomnia was the catalyst for everything, not being able to go back to sleep and heal.
You were afraid to go back to sleep, presumably.
I was afraid to go back to sleep because I knew what was going to happen. It was happening night in, night out, and it was just so violent, and I'd wake up and I'd not be able to go back to sleep because, I mean, we've had nightmares before, right? And they kind of stay in your mind for a minute or two and then you're trying to drift back off. You know, I couldn't shake it. I just, and, you know, it ate into my sleep, which ate into everything else and my ability just to be a person.
I'm very lucky. I've never suffered from insomnia, but I've had a few nights of bad sleep. And I know how it can affect you the next day or even that week. Mm-hmm. You say that you had, was it about 6 years of insomnia?
Yeah, I would, quote unquote, work off about an hour and a half of broken sleep. So I would be kind of, you know, that when you're waiting for, like, let's say you're flying away and you know you have to be up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you wake up before your alarm. That was kind of that. I was really light sleep. And, you know, I would start feeling like a prisoner in my own room. I was just tossing and turning. I was hyper aware of not being able to go to sleep. You know, 5 minutes felt like 2 hours. And I eventually stopped trying to go to sleep. And, you know, in the height of it, I would be driving to Cork and back to fill the nights because I just couldn't.
From Dublin?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Just I couldn't lie in my room anymore. I couldn't just, like, sit there as a prisoner. So I would get in the car. I wouldn't set out to drive to Cork, but I would find myself in Cork and then I'd drive back. That's how I would fill the nights.
Were you talking to anybody at this point? I mean, were you telling people what was going on?
No. There lies one of the issues with mental health problems is, you know, the easiest person to fool is yourself. And I was telling myself, this is fine. This is, you know, a growing pain. This is part of getting back. My body's just trying to digest what's happened. At that stage, no. It wasn't until things kind of pushed along and I tried to get back into work. You know, being from athletics, you get injured, you rehab and you get back as soon as you can. And that's the mentality I brought into work. And we were all sitting in the patrol car one day and we just got this very mundane call, just go out and check out premises. And I remember my collar feeling like it was tightening and the seatbelt pulling me into the chair and my stab vest feeling like just a ton weight. I'm an asthmatic and I thought it was an asthma attack. Mm. So I took my inhaler and it didn't really help. So I went back to my sergeant and he kind of said, you need to really look at what's going on here. So you need to take some time. And
sounds like was it a panic attack?
Or it was a panic attack, yeah. It was a panic attack and I've never experienced that before. Like, before all of this, I would, you know, I would be sad like everyone else would be sad, but it would never kind of, you know, take over my life. And when I, basically when I got back on sick leave to try to get better, it just started spiraling out of control and overwhelming feelings of frustration. I always let my unit down. I felt like I was letting myself down. All my connections with my friends and my girlfriend at the time, that all frayed apart. You know, I stopped doing the things that, you know, gave me hope, like training or eating well. Everything just, you know, fell apart on me. And, you know, depression really, really set in and it really weighed me down. It was so difficult to try to deal with that again without that sleep. And I still to this day believe that, you know, the sleep was the biggest stepping stone for me to try to get around.
Because you had no energy, you had no fresh energy 100%. Every morning or every day to kind of face the problems during the day.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
You describe it so well, and I'm sure there's people listening who have suffered from insomnia, maybe still are, and it sounds horrendous, to be quite honest, and it went on for such a long time for you.
Yeah.
What happened? Where was the turning point?
So much like many stories I've heard in the past, it's at your lowest point you get your turning point. And I got to a stage where, and again, here's like, for me, one of the issues when I was suffering was my ability to, you know, see the options that were ahead of me, and I didn't see there was options. I didn't think there was any hope. So I felt that the only option was to try and take my life, to try to, you know, separate myself from the depression, from feeling like a failure, and that turbulent energy of anxiety and depression and the dreams and stuff like that. So, you know, I was in a position where I felt like that was the only option. And obviously it's not, but when you're not thinking straight, that's what it feels like.
Mm-hmm. You obviously didn't do that.
I got so lucky, yeah.
You were lucky, you say.
Very, very, very lucky. So
I mean, came back from the edge.
I got, yeah, absolutely.
When did you get back on a sled?
Oh, 2020. I did a small little bit in 2015, and then it was 2016-17 season where I went full into this.
But was it, you know, was there a period in the dark times where, you know, did anybody say to you, or did you think yourself, maybe I should get back into sledding, maybe I need to get back into doing something active again?
So it was after I had my low point that I started to get back into things. I actually went to my friends and I just talked to him and I said, hey, this is what happened. I'm telling you now because I just want to be held accountable. I just want someone on this planet to know what's going on so I can say, hey, I'm not okay today and you know what's going on. And he said, just go back to the gym. That's what you know and that's what you love. So I started training again. You know, nothing compared to what I used to do, but just small bits every day. And I eventually got back to the point where I was training athletics. And I had a chance, it was literally random chance run in with the then president of the Irish Bobsled and Skeleton Federation. And he said, you should give it a go. And here I am.
That's incredible.
Lucky times too.
What a good friend you have.
Yeah, absolutely.
What a very good friend
amazing.
You have.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, we talk a lot about mental health and about how sharing problems and talking to people close to you helps. And your friend obviously just said something very simple to you.
100%.
Pointed you in the right direction.
He knew me, so.
Yeah. So look, you're on the skeleton. We should point out that you left the guards a couple of years ago, didn't you? You're not a guard anymore.
No, I'm not a guard anymore. You know, I loved the job and I worked hard to get in and I worked hard to stay there. But at the end of the day, I had to look after my mental health, and you know, it's not something as easy as rehabbing a muscular injury. So I had to just take that step back, and it was a very, very tough decision. But luckily, again, I'm going to bring this back to friends. There's a lot of colleagues in the job who, I mean, they know who they are, but they did massive work to help me realise that this is the best step for me. So, because I'm battling with people outside the job and say, it's a permanent pensionable job, it's this, it's that, and
yeah,
all that.
Of course, of course.
But
yeah.
Inside the job, they're like, your mental health means more than anything.
It does, of course it does. And and I suppose, look, particularly a job like that where you are faced with stressful situations on an ongoing basis, on a daily basis.
Daily basis,
and you don't know what you're heading into. It wasn't going to be the right place for you.
No, not at all.
So you're now on a different journey, which involves hopefully heading to the Olympics in Beijing in 2022.
Yep.
Where are you now in the sport, and what sort of training are you doing?
So right now, last Olympic season, I missed out the qualification by a single point. I was so heartbreaking
and
close.
And when was this?
This is February 2018. Okay. So
This
is Pyeongchang. Yeah. And, you know, that was a tough month for me. That was another test to see, you know, if I really wanted this. And, you know, I picked myself back up and I committed to it. And I'm so glad I did, because last season I had a breakthrough season. You know, I got my first career medal. I broke personal best at every single track I went to. I finished 22nd in the World Championships, and I qualified Ireland for the highest level of competition, which is World Cup, for the first time since 2013.
That's incredible.
So I had a great season last year. So I'm trying to work on that now. So where I am right now, I'm training out in the Sports Ireland Institute out in Blanchardstown. I train there full time. And, you know, I'm working on the European Championships and the European circuit this year. And then going into pre-Olympic season, I'll be ready for the Olympic season.
Okay, so it's Beijing 2022 that you've got your eyes set on.
Yeah.
It's your full-time job.
This is, I mean, the margins in sport right now are so narrow that you have to commit everything to it, and I'm all or nothing. So this is what I'm focused on.
What's the funding like? And because we know that sport can be very tricky, and if it's your full-time job, you need support, don't you?
Absolutely. You know, Skeleton is like Formula One on ice. It has the price tag along with it. And right now, you know, I have got help from the Olympic Federation of Ireland, but, you know, I need so much more help, and I'm doing a lot of work myself trying to form partnerships to bring me through to 2022. And it's very difficult because, again, I'm a one-man band. I'm doing everything myself. So, you know, funding is a massive, massive bottleneck.
You mentioned the Formula One. I'm picturing now, of course, because it is great watching the Winter Olympics, actually. It's fantastic to watch. And the sleds are very slick machines. I mean, do you have your own at the moment?
Yeah, I have my own. It's a Willy Schneider sled. So it's a German built sled. You know,
how much would one of them put you by?
$10,000.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and then the steel. So if you can kind of visualize a tea tray with two kind of metal rods on the bottom, so that's where the rubber meets the road, essentially. Those runners, those steel rods, are about $700-$800 a pair. And we need 5 or 6 pairs depending on weather and ice conditions and the track, and there's so many different things. But yeah, the costs amount up really quickly.
Do you have to, as well, during the season, obviously you're on a track now at the moment, but I mean, do you have to go and get on the ice as well during, you know, during your practice? And is there anything like that available in Ireland for you to practice on?
No, nothing yet. There's push houses in Bath. The British team have really put a lot of funding into this, and they're one of the powerhouses right now. So they have a facility in Bath. Unfortunately, I can't get onto it, but you know, I'm doing what I can, cool running style. I've made my own little track that I put down, and you know, I'll probably head out to Germany a week or two before the season starts to get some ice post training, and then start training.
When does the season start?
It'll be October, for second week of October.
Okay, so that's the name to remember and the name to watch out for this bobsleigh season is Brendan Doyle, as he, hopefully, the Olympic ambitions, everything comes good for you, because Brendan, your story is incredible. Thank you for sharing it with us this morning. Beijing 2022.
I can see it now,
Brendan.
I'll see you there.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. And you know, just because some people might be listening, suffering from things like insomnia, from depression, from mental health issues, we'll always give out the numbers to you. The Samaritans, you can telephone them 116 123. Aware, you can phone them 1800 80 48 48. And Pieta House, of course, they have a website, pieta.ie, and you can call their National Suicide Helpline. It's 1800 247 247. We'll take a quick break.